There are so many issues throughout all levels of government that smart Christians need to view it as a way to care for our neighbor by making good decisions.
Molly Hemingway talking about her joint presentation with her husband, Mark, at the 2020 Virtual Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
The federal government has gotten much more involved in family formation or family destruction, abortion, other issues. And there are so many ways in which it's important for us to think about how we can defend the weak and vulnerable among us by making good decisions.
You can watch journalists Molly and Mark Hemingway making the case for Christian political engagement at this year's Virtual Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. The premier conference for Christian laity is Friday, July 24th and Saturday, July 25th. The $135 registration fee includes the ability to watch a live stream and a recording. Learn more and register at issuesetc.org.
I wish we taught more in our schools about the Islamic faith. I wish we talked about all the great confessional faiths. And what people don't realize is one of my avocation is theology.
It's interesting that the sort of like traditional American leftism is clashing with, you know, millennial progressivism.
The Reformation was not a revolution. And thinking we have to take on and imitate the worship styles and practices of non-sacramental Christians is very dangerous.
I think the first thing is just knowing the arguments about the truth of the matter. That's why shows like yours, Issues Etc., are so important, because you're equipping people to make the argument.
Iowa State University computer science graduates love Issues Etc.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
The United Nations was formed in 1945 with the goal of maintaining international peace and security, developing friendly relationships among the nations, and achieving international cooperation to be a center for harmonizing the actions of nations. So that sounds good. Why is the United Nations bent upon destroying the family? And in some cases, if you listen to some of their internal documents, taking children away from their parents. Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in on this Thursday afternoon, the 23rd of July. We'll discuss the United Nations and anti-family policies with Kimberly Ells, and then we'll look forward to Sunday morning, according to the three-year lectionary, talking with Dr. Carl Fakencher about the parables of the hidden treasure, the pearl of great price, and of the net. Kimberly Ells is policy advisor for Family Watch International, author of the new book, The Invincible Family, Why the Global Campaign to Crush Motherhood and Fatherhood Can't Win. Kimberly, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you, Todd.
What did you discover about the United Nations agenda for the family and children?
Well, initially, how I entered this realm of understanding what's going on at the international level is I happened upon a document online, actually, that was published by International Planned Parenthood Federation, and it detailed the issue of children's sexual rights. It was promoting children's sexual rights, and I didn't know that there was such a movement, you know, at least in mainstream circles. And so I was very concerned about that, and the more I got looking into that, the more evident it became that the United Nations was also tied in with this agenda. Of course, they openly partner with International Planned Parenthood Federation on many levels. And then there's the documents that are produced by UNESCO and UNFPA and so forth, and even some from UNICEF, the children's organization that's supposed to protect children worldwide, seem to be on board with the children's sexual rights movement. And a lot of the language and the documents and their various publications are very troubling. And what I mean by children's sexual rights is it's basically promoting to minors this idea that it's their human right to pursue and experience sexual pleasure, apart from marriage, apart from family or childbearing or even responsibility on some levels, that it's just a right that should be pursued.
Why is the UN and the NGOs that you mentioned there, why are they pursuing this agenda?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question, because who would pursue such an agenda? Most people find it very troubling and repulsive even. So I think there's a couple different reasons for it. One is that as we all are becoming more aware of, the UN is interested in global power. In fact, there was an article out just today that I saw from the Secretary General of the United Nations declaring that there was a new model for global governance is on the way and that we should prepare ourselves for that. So the UN is after global power, and it's been on that path for quite some time, and it's getting more pronounced now. So the power that resides naturally in the family, with a mother and a father providing for and presiding over their children, is in direct conflict with other forms of power and other forms of government. The family has inherent power. And so, of course, the UN, if it's going to claim power and authority, needs to lessen, weaken, and even destroy the power that's within the family. And one way to do that is through changing the sexual norms in society and it's kind of severing childbearing from sex, convincing the younger generation that those things are not and should not be necessarily connected, and so forth. And it also starts children on a path to possible sexual addiction, starting them very early, which weakens them and makes them more susceptible to being controlled.
What do socialism and radical feminism want for women?
Well, you know, feminism started out, you know, years and many, many decades before on a good path with seeking basic human rights and legal rights for women. But what I talk about in my book, The Invincible Family, is that modern feminism, what most people would call radical feminism, is after something much more aggressive and very different. And so the feminists in the early 70s, I specifically talk about Shulamith Firestone in the book and her views. She very much wants to destroy the family, wants to weaken the ties between mothers and their children. Specifically, she targets that because it's necessary. If you're going to disband the family, you have to strike at that point. And so her philosophy and the growing philosophy in the world is that women should be freed from the care of their own families, and that somehow is better for them. Her arguments and more modern growing arguments are also in line with the children's sexual rights movement that I mentioned. Shulamith Firestone talks about that children should have autonomy in their sexual choices and all kinds of sexual pairings should be fine, and things that most people find very, very disturbing. And so the modern feminism of today, unfortunately, is seeking to break apart the family and to tell the woman that she has a lot more important things to do. Not that women can't do things other than raise a family. They certainly can. I do. Most of the women I know do. But for most mothers, that's where their heart lies. That's one of their top priorities, if not their top priority. So, and you also asked about socialism. So in concert with that, there's a growing, of course, kind of push for socialism in our world today, which many of us find disturbing, and we can't quite see where that's coming from. But if you look back to the founders, of course, of modern socialism, specifically Karl Marx, and I talk a great deal about Friedrich Engels in the book, they were unabashedly in favor of abolishing the family. You know, that's in the Communist Manifesto that they originally wrote. And so, again, why is that? It's because there's inherent power in the family, and they want to usurp that power and have the state take over the power that exists in the family. So you have to break it apart in order to do that.
How does our basic anatomy give an answer to the goals of both feminism and socialism in that respect?
Okay, so that's a great question. It's fascinating if you think about it, because any kind of regime or powerful person or whatever that's seeking power and they want their power to last a long time, what do? They go for the youth, because if you control what the youth think, what little children are taught, then essentially you own the future, because they're going to grow up and most likely embrace and continue to believe and act upon the values that you've taught them when they're young. Lenin famously said, "Give me 4 years and the seed that I've planted will never be uprooted." And there's a great truth in that. But if you'll notice, the youth of the world, babies, if you will, where do they appear? When someone's born, when someone's new on the earth, where do they go? They go to a woman, and it's always a woman. They come to a mother, of course, in concert with a father. And so if you look a little bit closer, it becomes quite obvious that women are in a position of great inherent power just by their position as being mothers, because it's as if their anatomy and if the world, the way that it's shaped itself, hands the youth of the world right over to her, directly. And I believe, and this is the position I take in the book, that's because she wields the power best, because she loves the child most. And so that is something that is very hard to sever, that connection between mother and child. You almost can't get rid of it. There's some ways maybe we'll talk about in a minute that that is beginning to happen, but it's really, really hard to break, and that seems to be on purpose because it's designed into our human anatomy.
You say that people experience the highest degree of freedom in carrying out their duties as parents. What do you mean by that?
Right. Well, by and large, parenthood, motherhood, or fatherhood are not regulated by the state, other than, of course, protecting children from grave abuse and so forth, which should happen. But, you know, no one's telling a mom or a dad day to day what they need to teach their child or how what they should do with their child. The parents have a great deal of latitude in what they teach their kids, what they do with their kids. You know, if they think a certain tradition is important, they do it. If they think a certain ideology ought to be taught, or since certain principles ought to be taught to their children, they can do it. And there's not a great deal of outside interference, because the family creates itself this little private pocket that exists. And that's one thing I mentioned in the book, The Invincible Family, is that, again, that seems to be on purpose, and that parenthood, and specifically motherhood, kind of orients the world to be privately regulated rather than publicly regulated, if that makes sense.
What do socialism and radical feminism want for men?
Oh, right, not much, I'm afraid. Yeah, so modern feminism, radical feminism, is unfortunately very anti-man. I'm sure that's not news to you or to most people. Feminism seeks to tell a woman that she doesn't need a man for anything, even raising children, that the fathers and men are unimportant, you can do it all. When in reality, you know, reams of social science evidence present data to the contrary, that fathers, in fact, are very important for the youth. So, you know, there's this narrative today that masculinity is toxic and fathers are abusive and angry. And although that may exist on some levels for some people, by and large, the data shows that men act as protectors. Masculinity is not toxic. It's actually a productive force when applied appropriately that leads to a great deal of productivity and all kinds of good things when it's channeled properly. So men, I think, have gotten the short end of the deal recently with these modern women's movements, because men are essential and their roles are different than women's in many cases, and both roles are essential and meant to be complementary.
Why do socialism and radical feminism want to eliminate the very distinction between the sexes?
Okay, that's an important concept. I mentioned Shulamith Firestone, and she outright said, she said the goal of radical feminism is not just to eliminate what she called male privilege, but to eliminate the sex distinction itself, so that sex no longer matters culturally. Like, it doesn't matter what your body is composed of or what genitalia you have, it's just everyone is exactly the same. When in fact, we're not exactly the same, are we? We're quite a bit different. Men and women are inherently designed differently, and those differences are good and cooperative, as I mentioned. And so, unfortunately, the good doctrine of equality has been, in my opinion, corrupted in such a way that it has come to mean exact sameness. And since men and women are not exactly the same, that's a problem. And so that leads to a lot of different things that we're witnessing in our culture now. If you try to make men and women exactly the same, you're going to run into a lot of problems, because they simply aren't.
We're talking about the United Nations and anti-family policies. Kimberly Ells, author of the new book, The Invincible Family, Why the Global Campaign to Crush Motherhood and Fatherhood Can't Win, is our guest when we come back. Does it surprise her to read op-eds in the New York Times speaking of pedophilia as a disorder and not a crime? You can watch and hear Mark and Molly Hemingway, Matt Walsh, Chris Roseborough, Greg Kokel, Hans Feeney, and Katie Faust at the 2020 Virtual Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. Making the Case is Friday, July 24th and Saturday, July 25th. The $135 registration fee includes both live and on-demand viewing. For more information and to register, visit issuesetc.org or give us a call, 618-223-8255. 8385.
The Simply Classical curriculum for special needs moves at my child's pace and gives her exactly what she needs. So writes Amber, a homeschooling mother who has joined thousands in homes and schools teaching from this uniquely Christian classical approach to special education. Teach students with autism, learning disabilities, or Down syndrome based on ability level rather than chronological age. Use promo code LPR20 today at classicalspecialneeds.com. Classicalspecialneeds.com.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Your church's chrismons are from the 80s. They're made of styrofoam, their glitter is shedding, and they're held together with toothpicks. Now is the perfect time to replace them with Adcruzman's Christmas in July sale. Participating artists have discounted their products, so stock up on jewelry, crucifixes, art, church banners, music, greeting cards, and more. Discounts range from 10 to 50% off. Visit us at adcrucem.com to take advantage of the sale. That's adcrucem.com.
The COVID-19 pandemic has caused many Christians to ask about whether or not the government should be telling the church when and how to gather around our Lord's gifts. In the June-July issue of the Lutheran Witness, the Reverend Christopher Thoma takes up this question in his article titled, Executive Orders, Divine Command. To read this excellent article and more about the church's life in the midst of a pandemic, subscribe to the Lutheran Witness today at cph.org/witness. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran perspective, cph.org/witness.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking with Kimberly Ells, Policy Advisor for Family Watch International, about the United Nations and anti-family policies. Kimberly, given everything we said before the break, does it surprise you to read an op-ed in the New York Times recently speaking of pedophilia as a disorder and not a crime?
Yeah, absolutely. Most people who have been in favor of it have been in favor of it, but on grounds of equality and wanting people's dignity to be upheld. And of course, those are good things. But the problem is, when we cease to recognize gender or sex in marriage, then where would it be relevant? If we're not going to recognize it in marriage, which is the very seat of society, and that's the place where children are born and nurtured and taught. If we say that gender differences or sex differences, whichever way you want to call it, are irrelevant, then it doesn't matter anywhere. How could it matter anywhere else if it doesn't matter in the family? And so, yes, same-sex marriage, although many people who supported it didn't necessarily want this to happen or see this coming, what it is doing is breaking down even the recognition of differences between the sexes, certainly the complementarity of the sexes, at a very primal place in the family.
Someone at this point might say, well, Kimberly, Shulamith's Firestone is a fringe character. This can't have found its way into mainstream thought. How do you respond to that?
I wish that were true. And even in her time, perhaps she was fringe. But the thing is, that very philosophy, I think we all see it growing. One place that I've seen the radical feminist movement growing is in the writings of one woman named Sophie Lewis, who I quote in the book. And again, someone might say that she is fringe, but let me just tell you some of her philosophy. She is outright and boldly in favor of family abolition. And she's just writing now. She put her first book out last year, and her book is called Full Surrogacy Now, Feminism Against Family. And so more and more, that is the current that we're seeing in feminism, that it's anti-family, if not overtly, then certainly in other ways. But she's overtly against family. And certainly, my experience at the United Nations has shown me that the attitudes there, which tend to have a great trickle-down in the societies of the world, the feminism there is quite in line with both Shulamith Firestone and Sophie Lewis have taught. And even there's a program for youth in the United States that's, well, I think it's about 1 million of United States high school students are being exposed to is funded by the Novo Foundation, which is a radical feminist organization. Their tenets sound very much in line with the things that we're talking about. And so if that's who's funding some of these movements, that's a clue as to what their objectives may be. And so, you know, they're very careful in their language. Most people don't come out and say they want to destroy motherhood and the family and get fathers out of the picture. But when you look closely, that is what the agenda is driving for.
So what do people like Firestone and Lewis, what do they propose take the place of the family? If the family needs to be eliminated in life and in law, what's going to rush in to fill the void, in their view?
Because something has to, right? If the family isn't going to be there, what is? So Sophie Lewis's answer, she calls directly for what she calls gestational communism. And so she's all in favor of a communistic communal state. And what she suggests is that, like, when a baby is born, most people believe, and this is the tack I take in the book, that when a baby is born, it belongs to its mother. Inherently, it belongs. And the mother belongs to the child. The child has a direct link to and claim upon the mother. And this is something that's foundational, has been foundational for pretty much forever. But what Lewis says is that the bonds, and Shalom Firestone said the same thing, that the bond between mother and child must be severed. And so Lewis suggests that when a baby is born, it doesn't belong to anyone. It should just be for everyone. And so somehow there's this that's apparently magically going to happen, is that everyone's going to want to care for random children that other people have born. Now, of course, throughout time, adoption has been a good and important thing for people whose parents cannot care for them, but that's a different thing. And yes, it's possible to love other people's children, but if we totally disannul all blood relationships, which is what these radical feminists are seeking to do, there's this massive chaos, and somehow we're going to assume that babies and children are going to be well taken care of. That's very unlikely. And so then if we tie this in with the international agenda, well, what is going to take its place? Sophie Lewis says she doesn't know, but that we should just kind of sit back and watch the magic happen. And, you know, there is no grand thing that's going to take the place of the family. If the family disbands, society will crumble. Now, the United Nations is happy to try to take the place of the family and try to take responsibility for doing all the things that the family now does, which is what they're aiming towards. But let me tell you something, that's not going to work. That's a pipe dream, that faraway agencies, even if they assign people close by to love children and take care of new people, it's not going to be the same as a mother. I'm sorry. And any mother, any father knows that.
How is procreation being commercialized?
On several levels. Surrogacy, of course, is the commercialization of babies and of women's wombs. There's a huge market for surrogacy now. There's also a growing opposition to surrogacy from many different organizations and groups of people. And surrogacy is often presented as a great way for poor women to earn money, but it's inherently exploitive. If you have to be so poor that you're going to subject yourself to this, that's just not even a fair deal. It never can be, especially considering the risks to women. So surrogacy always sounds nice. The arguments for it are often well received, and then countries or states open it up. And then what we've seen, like in the case with India, they saw the very devastating effects it was having on their nation and on the women of their nation, and they've since largely put a stop to commercial surrogacy. However, for instance, in New York State, just a few months ago, the commercial surrogacy was legalized, kind of quietly, while the rest of us were preoccupied with COVID-19. Commercial surrogacy was legalized in New York State. And an interesting piece of the puzzle with that is a couple of years before that, sort of a committee was put together to study this issue and to help New York decide if they should do this, if they should legalize surrogacy. And one of the arguments that this team came up with is that since gay marriage had been legalized in the United States, that in the name of equality and equity, that children needed to be made available to all couples, to all married people. So you can see that, again, even if the intention was not for genderless marriage to commercialize people, that is exactly where it's leading. And even those who are pushing surrogacy are admitting that. Because if you're going to have two men have a baby, you have to exploit a woman on some level, or she has to freely volunteer to gestate a baby. There's just no other way around it, because the two, a male-male pairing and a female-male pairing, are not the same. One is inherently regenerative and one inherently is not. Even though there may be some heterosexual couples who cannot have children, it remains that the inherent nature of same-sex couples is they can't reproduce. And so if you're going to have what's called equity in childbearing, then there has to be money changing hands, or at the very least regulation and redistribution of babies, which is what is happening.
Let's talk a little bit about abortion. You say that legalized abortion opens the door for coercion to be loosed on women from outside parties, including the state. What do you mean by that?
That's exactly the case. Again, it's just ironic that for so long, abortion has been pushed as a woman's right, when in fact, one of the things that it does is sexually emboldens men. Because if by their actions, a woman becomes pregnant, well, it's no big deal, because she can just exercise one of her fabulous rights and have an abortion. Do you see what I mean? It takes away the momentousness of having sex and of creating life itself, which is very problematic.
Is abortion a first step toward convincing women of that kind of fourth agenda item for radical feminism and socialism when it comes to the family, that is convincing women to give up their children voluntarily?
Yes, exactly. So what Firestone and Lewis wanted was the bond between mother and child to be severed. And what abortion helps accomplish is for the woman to do that herself, which is really quite chilling if you think about it. And I tie this in the book to what we've seen happen in China. Forced abortion is the norm, has historically been the norm for the women of China. If they don't have permission from the state to bear a child, then they can't. And why is that? Because the state has usurped the authority to regulate childbearing. Where should that power reside? That should reside in the family with a man and a woman. But in China, the state has overtaken that piece, that very key piece of power. And it's been devastating to women as well as men in China, to families in China.
You also tie it into New York and other states, a passage of what you call libertine abortion law in 2019. Tell us about that.
Yeah, what I think most people don't realize, and again, I have sympathy for people who are in favor of women's rights. I'm in favor of women's rights. Virtually everyone is in favor of women's rights on a certain level. But when you take it to the level of saying that a woman's right to have a baby is the same as a woman's right to eliminate her baby, those things are not equal. They are not the same. And so I think, unfortunately, what we're doing as we legalize abortion more and more, then as federal and then, unfortunately, global entities take on more power, because abortion will be legal, they'll be in a position to coerce women or force women into having abortions. And so it's very cunning to convince women that it's their great right and privilege to have an abortion, when, at least for some, it seems the end game is to be able to legalize abortion so that they can force it upon women.
On the other side of the break, if women should have sexual rights, and Kimberly L. says they should, what should they actually look like? I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc.
For your next family vacation, consider our beach house. A charming three-bedroom vacation rental on beautiful Siesta Key. Just off Sarasota, Florida, Siesta Key Beach, consistently voted America's best, is just 100 steps away. Whether you're watching the sunset over the Gulf of Mexico or frolicking in the warm surf, you and your family will fall in love with Siesta Key. Check us out at SiestaKeyRentalGenie.com or call Virginia at 941-266-1858.
In many ways, St. Matthew Lutheran Church in Bel Air, Maryland, is just like any other Lutheran Church Missouri Synod church. They have worship services each Sunday and reach out to their community, but one thing they don't do is pay their electric bill. Hello, this is Rahema Kavuga, Synod Relations Manager of Lutheran Church Extension Fund. And if you want to hear what St. Matthew actually did to eliminate their electric bill, just visit interesttime.org. That's interesttime.org.
Do you know any military veterans in your church or community? Do you have a passion to support and reach them with the gospel of Jesus Christ? Then Operation Barnabas is for you. Called by Christ's love, Operation Barnabas engages, empowers, and equips LCMS faith communities to provide hope, healing, and support to military-connected persons living in their community. Operation Barnabas is a program of LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces. Find out more at lcms.org/armedforces.
Greetings in Christ, and thank you for listening to Issues, etc. If you ever find yourself visiting the Smoky Mountains in East Tennessee, please join us here at St. Paul Lutheran Church in Sevierville. We see it as a small part of our service to the church to provide sound liturgical worship opportunities for vacationing Lutherans to our area. For worship times and directions, please visit our website at splctn.com. That's splctn.com.
We're supported by listeners like you. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
I think every man, every Christian should consider, at least, the possibility of God calling him into the holy ministry.
Issues, Etc. regular guest, Dr. Carl Fekencher of Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Because that's the way that God has designed for faith in Christ Jesus to be spread, for the gift of eternal life that Christ Jesus earned by his death and resurrection to be shared with people, by the washing of baptism for infants and for adults, for the instruction, the proclamation of the word that happens on a nonstop basis in God's kingdom. God uses people, he uses men to be those proclaimers, to be those men who share the sacraments.
If you've ever considered becoming a pastor, contact Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Their phone number, 1-800-481-2155, 1-800-481-2155, or visit ctsfw.edu.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about the United Nations and anti-family policies. Kimberly Ells is our guest. She's author of the new book, The Invincible Family, Why the Global Campaign to Crush Motherhood and Fatherhood Can't Win. Kimberly, you say that women should have sexual rights. If so, what should they actually look like?
So first, just briefly, what do they look like at the United Nations? I quickly learned when I went there that there's this grand thing they always present about sexual rights, and most of the time it's couched in terms of women. And the three things that just come up over and over again are a right to sexual pleasure, a right to contraception and abortion, and anyway, those are the main things that just keep bubbling up and up. Oh, and access to sexual information. Of any kind, basically. And so this is what's over and over again kind of preached to the women of the world at the United Nations. And that's problematic for women because women's nature is inherently life-giving. And so if you're telling her that her greatest right is to eliminate her life-giving capacities or to stifle or abort the consequences of her life-giving capacities, then that produces a lot of problems for women, which has been documented. Yeah, so what are women's sexual rights? If men and women are different, which they are, and if women have unique sexual rights, what are they? Well, you get a whole explanation in the book, but just a few points, is that a woman should have a right to have and to care for her own child. That should not be infringed upon. Again, that's not the same as deciding to eliminate one of her children, and she has a right to expect any man who wants to access her sexually to commit to her for life publicly first, because her ability to create life, once a life is created, that's forever. Once a child is born, and many would argue even conceived, that connection exists and is there. a child may die later or whatever, or it can even be aborted, but that connection exists. And so a woman has a right to demand marriage, basically, of any man before they have sex. And this used to be the norm. And so I found myself, you know, this voice in the wilderness kind of promoting chastity, but it's not an old-fashioned idea. It's the idea that best protects women and men, and it's a leverage that allows a woman to expect the best from her man. And family living, in most cases, brings out good in people. It doesn't mean that there aren't cases of abuse, but by and large, most parents rise to the occasion, right? If a man fathers a child and is married to the woman who bore it, chances are he's going to take pretty seriously his charge to take care of that baby. And so if we're worried about taking care of the most people in the world on a ongoing basis, we need to support the family. And that starts with keeping sex within the realm of the family.
What role does transgenderism play in these efforts to dislocate the family?
Again, let me reference the United Nations. So obviously, we all know about the transgenderism surge that is happening right now. Wonderful book that was just written, very recently published by Abigail Schreier that everyone should read, is really, really fabulous, Irreversible Damage. But anyway, so she explains this phenomenon and happening of transgenderism, and especially in young girls. But how these things are all connected is, like we talked about before, that if the goal is to eliminate the sex difference altogether, what better accomplishes that than transgenderism? Because it says that the substance of somebody's body is irrelevant. It doesn't matter. And in fact, you can just swap it around. Like you can, you know, have a sex change, or you can get different sex organs or cut yours off. And so it really accomplishes this goal of nullifying the meaning, any meaning in the body itself. And so when you do that, though, it's a very dangerous line, because then if gender or sex don't matter at all, then is anything that's, any role that is sex specific, it becomes hard to define that anymore or to protect anymore. What I'm talking about specifically is mother and father, because the role of mother is sex specific, right? And so as father, it needs to be a male person. But if we can no longer decide or agree upon what is male or female, then the protections of the family go out the window.
I recently interviewed Abigail Schreier on that book, and she talks a lot about the social contagion among young women. Does that tie into what you spoke about earlier, and that is the effort to get the youth on board first?
It absolutely does, and I've attended a few events at the United Nations that are very pro-transgenderism. And so not only is it happening in a very concerning way, hurting our daughters and sons here in the United States, but the thing is, it's being pushed at a global level. I've seen it, and we should all be concerned about that, no matter what side of the political aisle that we're on.
Talk a little bit more about what role same-sex marriage plays in this agenda.
Well, again, same-sex marriage is not a problem because it legitimizes people's sincere feelings for each other, because people of the same sex may have sincere feelings for each other. But the problem is when you enshrine marriage in law, same-sex marriage in law, then you require the state to take the position that the way children are created and produced somewhat doesn't matter. Because if everyone needs to have equal access to children, then we can't really say that the mother-child bond is unique or special or should be honored. You can't play both sides of that coin. And so the what starts out to be just wanting to expand marriage and the benefits of marriage to everyone, unfortunately brings with it the cracking of the bonds between mother and child and father and child, and changes the way that the law deals with marriage and children, which is concerning on a lot of levels.
How does the basic unit of the family give an answer to the goals of feminism and socialism?
Well, the family's answer is basically no, you can't have our children because they're inherently ours. You know, and that's the hopeful thing about the title of my book, The Invincible Family, because the family is what survives no matter what else comes along, no matter what else happens, no matter other regimes come and go, whatever wars happen. dynasties come and go, but what's the thing that always stays and always rises again? Even like a phoenix from the ashes, so to speak, it's the family, because it's inherent to our anatomy. There's a man, there's a woman, and together they can produce new life. And so the system sort of regenerates itself. And without any laws or any other things interfering, the family exists, and it always will.
What does the term sexual rights mean at the United Nations?
Yeah, I think I kind of skipped ahead and kind of covered that. But sexual rights meaning access to sexual information, demanding sexual pleasure as a right, and of course for women, abortion and contraception. And isn't it interesting that we never talk about men's sexual rights? That almost never is that discussed, and I find that intriguing.
Does anyone at the United Nations say, wait a minute, this is insanity? We are an organization formed to promote peace among the nations, and now we're micromanaging or attempting to micromanage the lives of 7 billion people.
Right. It should be obvious to anyone that that's not going to work, and it shouldn't work. And I will say that, of course, not everyone involved at the United Nations is bad or evil. In fact, I know a lot of really great people who are involved. And a lot of people want to help the world, help the people in the world, help the children in the world. The problem is that when you frame things the way they're being framed now in terms of equality, using that language, or in terms of honoring women or achieving women's rights, those things are very persuasive. And so a lot of people go along with those ideas, not fully understanding the destruction of the family that comes with it and the enabling of global power that it brings with it. And so I think there's a lot of very good meaning, good people involved in a lot of levels, even internationally, but this is something that we need to wake up to. We need to wake up to it individually and as a nation, that we should not sell the sovereignty of the family to anybody, to the federal government, and certainly not to a global government.
You spoke earlier about children's sexual rights in this agenda. It seems mm-hmm. a short step to me to sexualizing children, and to eventually, as it does in almost every case with men and women, the sexual exploitation of children. What are your thoughts there?
Yes, and unfortunately, yes, it's true. And of course, again, people who promote sexual rights for children wouldn't say that in those terms. But in the book, I go through in depth three programs of what's called comprehensive sexuality education. And my colleagues and I are not in opposition of sex ed per se. What we are in opposition of is this radical form of sex ed that's called comprehensive sexuality education, which, as you said, sexualizes children. It even leads them down the path to seeking out sexual experiences and suggesting to them new things that they never would have conceived of on their own. So I don't want to go into very gory detail, but that is presented in the book, hopefully in a tasteful way, but in a way that people can get an idea of what comprehensive sexuality education is, and that it is most definitely being promoted at the global level.
Kimberly Ells is policy advisor for Family Watch International. She's author of the new book, The Invincible Family, Why the Global Campaign to Crush Motherhood and Fatherhood Can't Win. We're talking about the United Nations and anti-family policies. Is the erasure of the sexual distinction also behind the redefinition of marriage, same-sex marriage, and this week in Massachusetts, polygamy?
What is God calling you to do? What is the one thing you were born to do? Are you truly doing what you're called to do? The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for July is Callings for Life, God's Plan, Your Purpose. It's published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040, or learn more about Callings for Life at issuesetc.org. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for July, Callings for Life, God's Plan, Your Purpose.
This week on The Word of the Lord Endures Forever, we'll close out Romans with final instructions and concluding doxology. Then we'll launch into St. Matthew with the book of the genealogy, from Abraham to Jesse, from David to the exile. Join me, Pastor Will Wheaton, for The Word of the Lord Endures Forever, your daily 15-minute verse-by-verse Bible study on demand at thewordendures.org and on the Lutheran Public Radio app.
Clear, concise, consistent. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Timeless truth that prepares scholars to serve their neighbor in all of life through their various vocations. This is what scholars receive at Wittenberg Academy. If you are looking for a solidly Lutheran online education for your child, consider Wittenberg Academy, where doctrine is sound, academics are rigorous, and relationships are genuine. We offer full-time, part-time, and diploma track options to meet your child's Lutheran education needs. We partner with brick-and-mortar schools and homeschools. You can find out more at wittenbergacademy.org.
Concordia University Chicago is committed to keeping college affordable for all, and especially for LCMS Lutherans. We have scholarships available specifically for students who are LCMS members. This is Dr. Russell Dawn, president of Concordia Chicago, asking you to encourage your student to check out Concordia Chicago at cuchicago.edu. And if you are interested in supporting these scholarships, please find us online at foundation@cuchicago.edu.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about the United Nations and anti-family policies. Kimberly Ells is our guest of Family Watch International. The 2020 virtual Issues Etc. Making the Case conference begins at 3 Central tomorrow, Friday, July the 24th, with a live broadcast of Issues Etc. We'll talk with Dr. Russell Dawn, president of Concordia University Chicago, about Lutheran higher education, and we'll discuss Jesus and Muhammad with Dr. Adam Francisco. Friday night's speaking lineup includes Matt Walsh and Katie Faust, followed by a Q&A. Saturday morning begins with Pastor Hans Feeney, followed by Mark and Molly Hemingway, and a Q&A with Jeff and me on the past and future of Issues Etc. Greg Kokel and Chris Roseborough will be speaking Saturday afternoon and wrapping up with a Q&A. There's still time for you to register. The $135 registration fee includes both live and on-demand viewing. Learn more and register at issuesetc.org or call 618-223-8385, the 2020 Virtual Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. Kimberly, is the erasure of the sexual distinction we've been talking about here, is it behind the redefinition of marriage with same-sex marriage and, as of this week in Massachusetts, polygamy?
Right, and some people have been warning about this for quite some time, and other people have said, oh, that's ridiculous, that will never happen, but I'm sorry to say that, you know, we are seeing hints of that now, because if you start to revere, in a sense, even reverence, some sexual orientations, how do you stop that? And even in the UN's own Universal Declaration on Human Rights, it says that the family is the core unit of society and is entitled to protection by society and the state. So it paints the family as something unique that deserves protection. But when we start to define the family in terms so broad that it really can't be defined anymore, then we lose the ability to protect it. And the reason we want to protect marriage and the family is because it protects new human beings. It's all centered there, and so if the attack is happening there, then that's where it has the greatest influence.
Within the last 20 years or so, there has been a big kind of informal push to expand the definition of family, I think for initially very good reasons, and that is to say, hey, not every family is father, mother, and a certain number of children. There are broken families. There are single-parent families. There are blended mm-hmm. families. All those kinds of things that we want to affirm as part of branches off of the natural family. But that has become increasingly, that motto, you know, anything is a family kind of notion has become increasingly deviant from even those deviations from the norm of mother, father, children. What are your thoughts?
Right. And of course there are different, you know, there are some cases where grandparents are taking care of children because various reasons, the parents have died or they're not capable of taking care. Obviously there are modifications that can be made for caring for children. The ones that are most effective are if it's family members that step in and help, and divorces happen. and families are blended. That's a reality, and that's something that we can deal with as a society. But when we start saying that anything can be a family, then family ceases to mean much at all, which is the very desire of radical feminists and radical socialists that we're seeing kind of come out of the woodwork more and more. And again, I don't think that most people who have been sympathetic to other family forms have had this as their intention, but it is what's occurring.
You spoke about comprehensive sex ed. How has education further been hijacked by the United Nations agenda for family and children?
Great question, and I have a whole big chapter on this in the book, so I won't bore you with all of the details, but there's a definite line running from the United Nations agencies focused through the Sustainable Development Goals, and then on down the line, partnerships with various global, national, and local organizations. And so I followed the kind of the breadcrumbs and the trails of those, at least some of those, in the book, and it becomes very clear that UNESCO's goal is to infiltrate and dominate the school systems of the world, including our country, and that they have laid a lot of groundwork in that direction. And in fact, it's already happening in many levels, especially through digital education and so forth. And I go into more detail, as I say in the book, but that is a reality. When I first started to learn about that, I thought, wait, what? That sounds a little bit outlandish. But as I've studied it more over the past 3 years, it's become more evident that is, in fact, the case. And it is, in fact, the goal. And UNESCO considers itself somewhat the czar of education for the whole world. And so they're trying to take it over in the name of equality, so that everyone is taught the same things and supposedly has the same opportunities and so forth. But when you remove local control, you remove a great deal of what matters most. And also you cut parents out of the loop, which is almost never a good idea.
Talk about some of the ways that the agenda against motherhood has been actually institutionalized and put into place.
Well, culturally, first of all, there's just, you know, for a very long time now, decades, there's been this push that it is a socialistic idea, actually, that the only work that is considered socially productive is work that's done in the public sphere, most often for money. And so you'll notice motherhood doesn't fall into that category, neither does fatherhood. And so if you convince people, specifically mothers themselves, that the work they do as mothers, which they're not paid for, is irrelevant, is not socially productive, and is in fact oppressive, then of course women are going to flee from that, or feel bad at least about that. And so there's been this growing kind of philosophy that, well, if you're not working for money, then you're worthless. But there's a lot more that matters in the world than money. And in fact, the thing that matters most is that good, decent, disciplined, loved children be taught and raised, because those are the people that then go on to be the workers and mothers and fathers and inventors and so forth of the world. But they have to start, it works best if they start from a place of love and connection, which happens in the family. And it does matter. No matter what loud voices may say in the world, it does matter.
Why is this agenda for the family and children doomed to fail?
Well, the agenda that the UN and International Planned Parenthood and the Novo Foundation and so many others are this global kind of takeover of the world, it's doomed to fail because it's not based on the family. And as I just said, the connection between mother and child and father and child matters more than I think any of us actually realize. So if you try to just say, wait, we're gonna enact global equality by getting rid of the family, you're going to find yourself in a world of hurt, because the family does the most work and invests the most in the rising generation of the world. And when you eliminate that, you gut the world, and the consequences will be catastrophic. And I think that we're seeing part of that come to pass now. There's a lot of forces at play, but one of the forces at play, I think, that we're witnessing the consequences of now in all this mayhem in our society is the fracturing of the family and what the teaching and love and so forth that's supposed to happen in the family. We're in some trouble.
Finally, what can parents and future parents do now to stand up to those determined to destroy the family?
Okay, thank you for that question, because it's very helpful, and there's so many things that can be done and that many parents are already doing. And I have a whole list of things in the book, that suggestions of things that can be done. Just a few that I'll point out is mothers and fathers should intentionally and purposely teach their children what they believe about sex, marriage, gender, and the family. And they should do it, find opportunity, create opportunities to do that on an ongoing basis, and to not be swayed by what the world is telling them they should teach their children, but tell them, teach them what they really believe about these things. And then another thing we can do is find out about comprehensive sexuality education and oppose it, expose it for what it is, and oppose it in every way possible. There's continual efforts. I mean, some of us are involved globally, and if you know an organization that's involved globally, you can help fund them. But there's a lot of work to be done locally, at local school boards, state school boards, your school district. If you find out that comprehensive sexuality education is being ushered in by the golden hands of Planned Parenthood or whatever, get in and fight it. Organize with others who are fighting it, because if we destroy the meaning of sex and take sex away from marriage, that's a huge win for destroying the family. So one resource I would specifically send people to is stopcse.org. That means stopcomprehensivesexualityeducation.org. Stopcse.org. There's a host of information on there to educate yourself about this, and then also to ways to connect with others to take action. One thing that I hope my book is helpful to families in this fight, and there's many other great books. I encourage people to get great books and read them. Read the stories of real people, as well as fiction, that teach your family the principles you want them to know. Because if you don't, the global regime that's kind of encroaching it is going to be more than happy to court your children the socialistic, feministic, sexual rights ideas. And so we have to be vigilant in immersing our children in truth rather than all these pieces of error that are out there.
Kimberly Ells is policy advisor for Family Watch International, author of the new book, The Invincible Family, Why the Global Campaign to Crush Motherhood and Fatherhood Can't Win. You can purchase this book at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Talk On Demand Archives. Kimberly, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Next hour, we'll look forward to Sunday morning, according to the 3-year lectionary, talking with Dr. Carl Fikencher about the parables of the hidden treasure, the pearl of great price, and of the net, in Matthew chapter 13. I'm Todd Wilkin. Stay with us.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.